Since 1957, the Germanic American Institute has been building cultural bridges between the American Midwest and German-speaking European countries. And this is our podcast. We cordially invite you on the inside to join us as we share insights into German grammar, the German cultural experience. We'll look at current topics, and we will let you know all about the events that we are involved in and you can participate in. At times, we will also invite guests on the show who'll share their knowledge and experiences with us, and we'll answer any questions you may have about our content or the GAI itself. Willkommen to the Germanic American Institute podcast.
And today is one of those special episodes. One of the guests that we welcome to our makeshift GAI podcasting studio is Dr. Heino Beckmann. He recently actually joined us at the GAI giving a presentation upon the topic of yearning for freedom. And we'll actually cover this here in a few minutes. But up front, let me introduce you to Dr. Beckmann. Professor Emeritus, University of St. Thomas, former member of the Armed Forces of Germany, an officer, and last but not least, most importantly, I would say, the Honorary Consul of the Federal Republic of Germany. Dr. Beckmann, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Can I just start with something that I would say most people are probably unfamiliar with? What is an Honorary Consul, and what are the tasks an Honorary Consul actually fulfills for the Republic of Germany?
Yeah, an Honorary Consul is appointed by the government of the, in Germany's case, by the President of the Federal Republic of Germany, and has consular duties as defined by the Viennese Convention on Consular Relations, to which the United States and Germany and many other countries are signatories. And we represent the country, in this case for me Germany, in the jurisdiction assigned to us. In our case, it was the state of Minnesota, the state of North Dakota, the state of South Dakota, and parts of Wisconsin. And we don't have any diplomatic duties, so we have no political duties to perform. What we are doing is simply protecting the rights of citizens of Germany who might have interests here in the United States, and of course also help Americans with interests in Germany to make that connection. I see the consular job in two different ways. One, I say, is the reactionary part, where people come to us because they have a problem. Let's say a German citizen living in the United States needs to apply for a pension in Germany. Well, the German consul in town will sign those papers and help the process. Or let's say a German citizen in the United States is being arrested by the police, ends up in jail. It's the consul's duty then to protect the rights of that German citizen who is incarcerated in the United States.
So you work, that position perhaps works in conjunction with the German embassy, or is it a completely isolated, autonomous position?
No, the consul, so the honorary consul, reports to the general consul, the consul general, which in our case is located in Chicago, and the consular duties are separate but related to the embassy. And so the embassy protects or argues for the political interests of Germany. And of course, the ambassador is a personal representative of the German president to the United States president. However, the consular duties are not separate from, but related to, yet independent in terms of reporting relationships. So the consul general do not report to the ambassador, they report to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Germany. However, also, of course, work together with the ambassador, with the embassy in the United States.
So for an American who has an interest, perhaps, or questions about moving to Germany or working in Germany, is this a stop that they should make to talk to the German consulates, or should they go straight to the embassy? Because I can see that this is a question perhaps that would come
well,
up.
Well, the embassy could not be helping.
Okay.
That person would come to the consul, mm-hmm. and the consul might not have all of the answers, but the consul has the connections, I suppose. And I always saw myself as a consul as a nexus of connections. Mm-hmm. I might not have the answers, but I know whom to ask or to whom to relate the question that was being asked of me. The more important part is the proactive part, and the proactive duties are without end. And so, as a consul, I'm charged with promoting the interests of German-American connections. And so, let's say in the field of business or education, we play the part of making those connections possible. And I say it's a field without any limitation because, yeah, there's always more work to do in education, in science, in culture, in business. And thus, most of the time of the consul is probably spent on the proactive part rather than the reactive part.
How can the impact of the proactiveness of the consulate be felt?
Well, in education, university education, trying to establish connections between American universities and German universities, helping with the exchange with student exchanges, promoting the opportunities that are available in Germany for foreign students to find an open ear here in the United States, and particularly if you consider that rather few American students study abroad, here's an opportunity to make all the opportunities available that Germany has. And Germany has as much an interest in having foreign students in the country as American universities would like to have foreign students here. And often the American public is not well informed of all of the opportunities that exist. All the same with opportunities for, let's say, exchanges or training opportunities in Germany for older adults, mid-career persons, 35-year-olds may take advantage of foundation monies, which are private foundation monies, but nonetheless available to Americans. Nobody knows about them. Or years ago when we had opportunities for young people whom in Germany would be considered apprentices, so people who have not university qualifications but are working in a trade, and Germany has an interest in promoting opportunities of Germans of all kinds of backgrounds to obtain some foreign experience and vice versa.
Is there a general resource, since you just noticed or explained that most people are actually unaware of the opportunities and the funding that is potentially available, is there a general resource where people can go to and actually inform themselves, or how does one really get the information to become an informed?
That is a very difficult question. I even don't know all of the resources that were available. However, as I said, in many of these situations, we have private foundations, company foundations that have made it their business to promote a particular aspect of social or economic development. And one has to know them. And consuls will never know them all, but they perhaps know a few more than one otherwise would. I have no particular directory that provides all of this information. However, one resource would always be the Außenhandelskammer, so the German-American Chambers of Commerce in outside of Germany, who will at least have access to some of the information, or most of the information. Certainly, cultural organizations in Germany would have the two. The one problem with all of that is that because of the federalism in Germany, much of the information is not available just to the federal government, and one has to search in the 16 countries, states of Germany, for particular information. It may or may not be helpful here and there.
So it almost makes it prohibitive to truly finding out, because it is quite a slog, so to speak, to actually get
Well, not
get
prohibitive, but yeah,
difficult.
It takes time, difficult, and one has to be a little bit proactive in identifying those resources. But the consul would be a good start to begin.
So that covers the proactive part. What is the life, the daily life of a consulate, of a consul look like?
Well, of course, I'm only speaking for the honorary consul. So an honorary consul is an unpaid position. And we are obligated or have the same responsibilities as professional consuls. So the professional diplomats that serve as consuls. And again, honorary consuls and consuls, or professional consuls, are all governed by the Viennese Convention on Consular Relations. However, the sending government can assign different duties to different consuls, and so usually a consul, a professional consul, has different and more responsibilities than an honorary consul. But the daily life of an honorary consul, in my case, Germany, has lots of work to do in Minnesota or in my district. I would say 25% of my professional time was spent on consular affairs. I had an interesting encounter once. I was walking through the art museum here in town with the director of the art museum, and she asked me the question, what was the joy of being a consul? And without thinking, I simply said, there is no joy, it's just work. And the next morning I sent an email and said, that was not really true. The joy of being a consul is to be able to help people who otherwise have no access to the services that they need in order to solve a problem. And in Germany's case, where we were responsible, or are responsible for reparation payments, let's say, to Nazi victims who happened to live in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, or in the district for which I was responsible, well, to make sure that their rights are protected and that their reparation payments are received or in proper order, and that was an important aspect of the job, and of course becomes less and less so as the Holocaust victims die. But probably some of the most interesting experiences I had as a consul, when a concentration camp victim would come into my office, and in German tell me, Mr. Consul, I want to speak German with you. I never want to return to Germany, but Germany is my mother tongue, and I want to speak with you in German. That was always a very, very amazing encounter which I had with people.
It's an incredible privilege to go back to those days and talk with people who have experienced a lot of things that we cannot even fathom.
That's right.
Are there, as a cultural representative of Germany immersed within the U.S. as a consul, what did you perceive the stark differences were in terms of cultural understanding, in terms of cultural interpretation? Are there differences? And if so, what do they look like? What do they feel like from your perspective, being well immersed within the American culture as well as living and breathing the German culture? You are, as you said in our conversation off the mic, sort of the bird on the fence.
Yeah, well, I think there are quite a number of aspects to that. So when I reflect on my decision to live in the United States, that prompted my commentary on being a bird on the fence, I suppose the any cultures, any two cultures, three cultures, are so different and so difficult to understand. And I do not claim to have an understanding of either the German or the American culture. However, my experience in the German culture was one, of course, through my upbringing, also an emotional one. I identified with Germany emotionally. And I still do that to this day. In the American culture, and I'm much more an observer because I didn't grow up in it, and everything that I know about America I acquired through learning, reading books and living in the country, a bit different from my childhood experiences in Germany. So there's a different way in which we learn about that culture. I suppose what I've learned over time is that I neither have a good understanding of the German nor the American culture. I see the German culture and the American culture in part through the eyes with which I was born and in which I was raised, German eyes. Mm-hmm. And then through my many, many years of life in the United States, I've lived in the United States longer than I've been in Germany. And I've also developed, of course, a perspective on America, and I say I have a second set of eyes, and that's the American eyes. And when I return to Germany, I look at Germany through two sets of eyes, German and American. And in the United States, I see events both through the German and the American eyes. I'm a stranger in both societies, in both cultures. In German, and that's when I'm saying I'm a bird on the fence. I'm observing and I'm not participating emotionally as much in a culture as I suppose at one point in time I used to do and most people I suppose do. So I'm more of an observer and commentator than a participant.
But it does give you a very unique vantage point to perhaps more authentically, if you will, evaluate what each aspect of culture is like, which the world views are informed by each individual culture. Do you see, other than, of course, the stereotypes of Lederhosen and beer and Birkenstocks and the things that are basically over-stereotyped, what are the nuances of cultural differences that you see between the U.S. and Germany, particularly given that what you just said, that everybody thinks that they know what's right for the other person? Where are the differences there?
Well, I think there's one important difference. I suppose we in Germany tend to believe that we learn so much more about America and the foreign world than Americans do. And thus we claim to have a certain knowledge base which is just superior when compared to Americans' understanding of Germany or the foreign world. No. Most Americans know that they don't know that much about the foreign world and are willing to ask questions. Germans who know everything about the foreign world don't ask questions anymore. They know it all. When I come home and talk to my family, who were mostly teachers in gymnasium, they tell me what America is all about. They know it better than I do. And I would say with a rather faulty understanding, and that of course gets to the question of nuances. Mm-hmm. I think it's so incredibly difficult to understand a different culture because if you come from a German perspective, I will never understand America. If I come from an American perspective, I will never understand Germany. And that has to do, I suppose, with the differences which are not just talked about, but they are in schools and in universities, but which are learned in a way in which cultures have formed over many centuries.
Can those two even be reconciled?
Well, yeah, I don't know whether they can be reconciled. In some instances, yes, in some instances, not. Since you mentioned earlier the question of my presentation here, the GI, about freedom. and so, which was entitled Yearning for Freedom, and my attempt was to say we have different conceptions of freedom. Mm-hmm. We all understand freedom, I suppose, both in Germany and in the United States. We understand freedom certainly in terms of the Bill of Rights, so the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom of assembly, and all of those good things which have been part of our life. And I suppose when we say freedom in the United States, we think of those freedoms, which are all rights which we have against the government. Mm-hmm. And the and the Bill of Rights was written as an instrument of freedoms against the government. And so we see government as a potential usurper of our freedoms, and thus we have to protect ourselves against the government. Now, I think that is so deeply ingrained in the American culture, not only with regard to the Bill of Rights, but essentially Americans see a government as a necessary evil. The less of it, the better. That's not the case in the German understanding or European understanding of government. Now, with regard to the other aspect of freedom, which we practice very well in the United States, but which we never acknowledge, namely the freedom defined as the ability to make deliberate choices. So being able to act deliberately. And in order to act deliberately, we might have to be enabled. And government often can serve that purpose. What is the purpose or the value of freedom of speech if you're hungry? What is the value of freedom of religion if you have nowhere to go? Your kids are starving from starvation, many of the necessary ingredients of simple life aren't given, then many of the American freedoms don't amount to much. Now, in the European context, there we have a somewhat different understanding or additional understanding of freedom that is to be enabled. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in his defense of the French Revolution, made this statement that men may be forced to be free. Men may be forced to be free. Now look at education. In the United States or in Germany, we force young children from age 6 to 16 to go to school. Mm-hmm. That is, as far as I'm concerned, certainly taking away the ability of a young person to make own choices, because from 6 to 16 you're being compelled to go to school, and if you don't, then the government can come after you. Now, we don't see the United States as an act of freedom. However, we justify it by saying, well, if we go to school, and do well in school, we might be better able to make decisions when we are adults. Or take the provision of old age pension. Social Security is, of course, I suppose, universally, except university meaning in Germany and in the United States, accepted a value that we wouldn't want to do without. At the same time, of course, you're paying taxes. So we're being made unfree paying the taxes in order for us to have a better life in old age. Now, this is, of course, a European or German experience ever since the 1870s, without which we couldn't even consider a life in Germany. And we have and have had in Germany a consensus about the government's duty to provide for old age, to provide for health, to provide for education. We have a consensus, now a little bit faltering, but nonetheless, generation old consensus that there are some social goods which are necessary to provide for the freedom that we all yearn for.
But if I go back to, let's say, the evolution of mankind in terms of tribalism, we always had some form of stewardship, somebody who took the mantle of responsibility to guide their tribe to survive. I would almost argue that sort of the same standards apply, except of course we now are governing more people, so we need more stewardship, a larger body of stewardship to actually lead us down the path that keeps us functional as a society. And that body that actually steers us and is our steward, they have a right for compensation. They are spending their time, their knowledge, to hopefully, in the best case scenario, give us the best of their guidance. Now, of course, this is in itself debatable. But when I summarize my understanding of how you just explained the essential understanding of freedom and the, let's just almost call it, indoctrination of children into schools that they perhaps don't want to attend, and I would almost say that most children don't want to go to school. They just want to play because that's what we do as kids. So we force them into a makeshift scenario that we have concocted just to create conformity. Now, the opposing fact to this would be a version of almost anarchy, to say freedom for everybody, do as you please, as long as it's in good keeping with ethical and moral standards.
Well, I wouldn't agree with you that going to school or the purpose of school is to educate children into conformity. No, from a freedom point of view, it is helping children to make future choices in a meaningful fashion. And so if you want to act purposefully and we have to do that on the basis of knowledge, and that knowledge is hopefully gained, in part at least, in education. And that's a justification government has to force children into schools. Not to, of course, we can also use it for propaganda purposes, and Germany has, certainly in the Nazi era, enough of a history of that. But apart from indoctrinating children, which I would think is not an act of freedom or making for freedom. Mm-hmm. The purpose of the school is to make people able to make better decisions for themselves and for the community.
So that would be a necessary evil in which we agree to, let's say, modify our freedoms for the almost better outcome in the future.
Yes, men may be forced to be free, in Jean-Jacques Rousseau's statement. So we are taking away freedoms today, namely the freedom to play, in order for that child to become more free, more able to make good decisions in the future.
I'm just making a massive leap with this entire subject, in a sense, to apply it to the American Second Amendment, which in Europe we do not have the amount of gun ownership and the, let's say, pride upon an amendment that essentially in that version doesn't exist in Austria, which I can more educatedly speak to that. But here we perhaps should apply the same standards to say the amount of gun violence that we are experiencing in the U.S., the amount of deaths that are coming through that, perhaps it would behoove us to also say, let's do something that in first instance restricts freedoms, but in the long run has a beneficial outcome. And the reason why I'm picking the Second Amendment is simply because this is the one that is most fought for outside of course, the First Amendment.
Yeah, well, to me that is a very amazing debate even that we have it here. And of course, as you said, you don't have it in Austria and you don't have it in Germany. So gun rights are greatly restricted, and in Germany you can apply for a weapons permit, and if you have a good reason to receive it, you get it, and you can be a gun collector, and as a gun collector, by all means, obtain whatever weapons you want as long as you have the proper permits for it. But if you look, let's say, at a hunter, well, in order to get a hunting license, you have to take 2 years of courses, and you have to take exams, and courses that end with exams which you have to pass. And part of the exams are how to handle a weapon. And so the ownership of weapons by hunters, licensed hunters, is well established. And most people are not hunters. They have no reason to have a weapon, so that they don't get weapons. And I suppose there's a society-wide understanding that weapons are not necessary tools in the hands of an average citizen. And if you go to Switzerland and realize that Swiss defense is based in part on the citizen army, where every soldier has its gun in its in his closet, mm-hmm. that's of course a different tradition and long-established tradition in the Swiss society. But there again, it never comes to a debate that we have here in the United States on the Second Amendment. I think here we use the Second Amendment as a polarizing aspect of American society. It has nothing to do really with just gun ownership. I think there's much, much more to it, to identify particular political positions. And we take the symbol of the Second Amendment as the one around which we all form our tribe. I think the debate on the Second Amendment in the United States has much to do with this notion that control by government is simply a negative, and we should protect society as much as possible from government. Totally different, talking about the nuances mm-hmm. of differences, mm-hmm. totally different in the European context, where government has often been used and been seen as a provider of many of the values that we're after. And so take, again, talking about the nuances, the enormous experience of voluntarism in the United States is not matched in Europe. If we want to have, if we want to solve a problem in the United States, we might turn to government, but we also turn to private individuals, or to businesses, or organizations which stand apart from government. In Europe, when we want to solve a problem, or let's say in continental Europe, the first thing we do is look to government, and government has often been the provider and the solver of our little problems, and. If you look at the willingness of people to fund social causes, well, in Europe it's done through government, through taxation. In the United States, you couldn't think of many of the values we practice here without philanthropy.
But wouldn't that be the outcome of, let's say, capitalism versus social democracy that is applied to the standards of a social contract that is being managed in Germany, Austria, Norway always comes up as the prime example of the unwritten social contract and the social democracy poster child, so to speak. Whereas in the US, with our economic methods and economic beliefs, perhaps we have to have these resources of volunteerism, churches, organizations, nonprofits, and so forth, who actually pick up where we in Europe are managed, taken care of. Here we don't have the type of management, so we need to look toward our fellow man.
Exactly, exactly. However, I look at it say, in terms of a continuum. In all societies, you have, well, let's say government, which takes care in so many ways, and much sometimes more or less. And then you have the voluntary participation without the necessarily influence of government on the other, not even on the other end of the spectrum. And, well, we try to find ways in which we can solve societies or people's problems, either with the help of government and or with the help of individuals or businesses that I suppose for purposes of drawing the distinction called capitalism and social democracy. I think we have, of course, in Europe, social democracy means also capitalism. And in the United States, capitalism also means some aspects of social democracy.
Absolutely.
So we are talking about a continuum, and the question is how much of what is where, and do we acknowledge that after all we have that take health insurance. The provision for health care is a value well understood, certainly in Germany. And there's consensus that everybody should have insurance to be taken care of in case of need. And it's not a political question. It's simply an aspect of social life.
Would it be the preferred system from a humanitarian perspective?
Well, I don't know that, but I don't know what is preferred. We would have to ask the people, what do you value here? And in the United States, we don't see it that way. And you can't get into Germany legally if you don't have health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, well, we make it an individual's choice to have or not to have it.
But is this an expression of not wanting it because of the unilateral application to everyone? Or is it the objection to attaining socialized healthcare, if you will, because it mandates a larger government body that actually administers it, going back to the objection of generally Americans to larger government bodies?
I would think that's the latter is certainly true. I would think it holds true for the United States. We are much too much afraid of government to give them more power yet. And of course, you can always point to the negative influences of government, because government overreach in so many respects is certainly always a negative example. However, that really begs the question. The question should be, do we as a society take care of our fellow human being? And if that is governing value, then the only question that arises is, well, how do we organize it? And what always amazes me in the American context, when we talk about healthcare, the next question is, how much does it cost?
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, whether it was in the discussion of Obamacare or any other schemes, we ask the question, well, what is it worth? No, we shouldn't say what is it worth. What does it cost?
Mm-hmm.
And what we should be asking the question in my book, and the Europeans ask the question and say, well, is it a social value that we are owing to our fellow citizen, fellow human being? And I suppose from that perspective, the question of cost is a management question. How can we reduce the cost of a value which we want to have, but we will have that value paid for. And now we can ask the question how we do it.
Well, that's going to be nearly impossible without a governing body, which brings us back into almost a circular argument to say without government oversight, which then could be interpreted as government overreach, we are not getting to the cost control mechanisms, if you will, and the application of control in itself, not to be a controlling instance, but somebody who sets the standards and adequately enforces them.
That's right, yeah. But if you consider, I mean, we are always concerned about the government doing all the work. I think there's only one healthcare system, I suppose the Canadian one, where we have government doing it all. In Germany, health insurance is managed by private companies. 200 companies manage German health insurance. However, important, the point you made, the government sets the standards,
mm-hmm.
and minimal standards have to be met. And those minimal standards provide for adequate care. If you prefer to be in a hospital by yourself in a room, well, then you have to buy additional private insurance. Otherwise, you are in a ward in which you might have two or three people with you in the same room. Well, so you can buy a little more on your own if you don't like the minimal standards which are set. But the minimal standards enforced by the government provide for adequate care for everyone.
But at least care is assured, as opposed to the potential of going bankrupt simply because you do have
That's
a
right.
medical issue, as we experienced,
That's
to 68% of American bankruptcies are medically related. There is obviously a systemic problem in how the system is being applied.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Certainly from the European point of view, definitely. I mean, this would be unacceptable in the European context. And
what makes it acceptable in the American context?
Oh, I think it's totally different. So one is the philosophical dislike of government. So that is so well ingrained in the American psyche and I suppose in American history, even though we see government everywhere and couldn't do without.
Right.
But nonetheless, we have this philosophical philosophical negation of government. And that's not the European experience. Yes, governments have overreached, governments have abused, but governments also have provided for much of what's good in society.
So the objection to the government almost has the potential to come at one's own detriment. Looking into the future, that somebody could potentially have a medical issue, and again, the 60+% of medical bankruptcies, of all bankruptcies, would validate the claim that by largely objecting to what I would refer to as social health care could actually be royally backfiring someday down the road when you have an issue and you find yourself inadequately insured.
Certainly, or not insured at all. I mean, if you consider, if we take the aspect of Obamacare that said you have a, you're mandated to have insurance even if you are healthy and well, otherwise think you wouldn't need it. But we all get old, or most of us at least get old if we aren't killed in a car accident or die from premature causes. But most of us get very old, and most of us will at some point in time in our life see a doctor. And I think if I look at my experience with American healthcare, certainly in the last enrolling period when I had to switch switch providers or insurance companies, well, what did we do? We essentially asked the question, how much healthcare did we need last year? And then we chose, well, a plan. And we didn't choose really an insurance plan. We chose a payment plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we could pool that risk and have, well, all of us in the same pool, and I will pay my taxes or my insurance, whatever we want to call it, the fees to be in that pool and be insured, and let's assume I turn 90 years old, I've never seen a doctor, I would never regret having been part of the pool, because I had the certainty that if I would need the health care, it would be available to me. And for a young person to say, well, I'm 40 years old, I've never had a health issue, I'd rather not become part of that pool. And then at age 80, perhaps needing that pool, and then, as it turns out, we always provide in the end. So Americans who are uninsured go to the emergency room are taken care of, not as well as they could be if they had been in proper mm-hmm. health care. So we don't let people die just because they don't have provided or purchased health insurance. But we could be much, much better. And often all of us could be better off if we simply said we all form a big risk pool, and we all know we healthcare is so basic to life that we all will need it probably at one point in time in our lives.
Let's clean up one common argument or one common perception, I suppose, that seems to exist and persist, if you will, within American viewpoints, is to say that, well, Germans' healthcare is free. Austrian healthcare is free of charge, and the Swiss are well taken care of. Everybody gets free healthcare, but it's actually not truly free. It comes through taxation. It comes through essentially contributions from the collective into a larger pool that, instead of just being for one family or for a congregation, if you will, that is now then being applied to everyone with the same set minimum standards. So in the context of economics, if you will, somebody who is, let's say, 25 and is after their first professional steps in their career. There is an employer-paid contribution to the healthcare system, and then there's an individual contribution as well. So essentially, the contributions come from two sides into that healthcare pool. And as we grow older, the probability of having an issue increases, but the good thing, quote-unquote good thing, if you will, is that over the course of time, we have paid so much into the system that we haven't consumed it on the front end. We likely will consume a portion or exceeding that portion of our contributions on the back end, because heart-related issues are not cheap, for instance.
Yeah, certainly. I think there's no such thing as a free health care. Someone has to pay for it, mm-hmm. and the only question, I suppose, is can we form a pool of individuals that share that risk, that pool that risk of needing health care at some point in time, and now we are paying for it. And how we pay for it, whether it's through taxation or individual contributions or however that system is designed, is of course relevant to the level of healthcare that can be provided. And if we don't make available the funds to provide for good healthcare, well, then we don't have good healthcare. No, there's no such thing as free healthcare anywhere in the world that I know, certainly not in Germany. And so whether it's now taxes or even the employer contributions are essentially taxes. Mm. So these are employment taxes that come with the simple fact that you have hired someone, and the law requires that everybody be covered by health insurance. And the next question is how do we collect the monies, the taxes necessary to do so. So that's a minor aspect. But the important point is that we recognize healthcare is costly, and we pay for it.
And it's on the whole a very finely tuned and balanced system that, with inaccuracies or with an overload of consumers or consumption on the payout side, can very quickly take significant damage, which makes me wonder about the Germans or Germany's position towards the immigration debate that is still raging in Europe to some degree, with individuals coming into the country with absolutely justifiable reason, as far as I'm concerned, because if I were to be confronted with unimaginable harm in my own home country, then yes, I would probably flee as well, but then I'm almost a persona non grata, if you will, going to the country that has shown a willingness to accept me as a refugee. Whereas the argument that I've heard from several sides is that, well, those people, quotation marks, come into the country, they are ill-equipped to contribute, but they are getting the same level of social standards that I'm getting as somebody who does contribute to the system. And that's where the aforementioned finely tuned balance perhaps comes into play, in a sense that, well, somebody who doesn't contribute but still is the beneficiary of such a system brings the system out of balance.
Well, it's certainly possible or true. You can overwhelm the system. Now, every immigrant or any migrant in Germany is covered by health insurance, for which he hasn't paid a dime, but that's simply the standard of society. Everybody is covered by adequate health care. Mm-hmm. As simple as that. However, since somebody has to pay for it, in this case, of course, through taxation, for those who pay taxes also provide the finances to support healthcare, well, it could very well be that the system gets overwhelmed. And I suppose you see that happening in Germany today or in Austria, with the emergence of right-wing parties, which have taken on a much bigger voice than they used to, and who flourish because, after all, people are concerned about the system to be overwhelmed by people who have made no contributions to the system. So the social consensus which made high taxation possible in Europe is a bit falling apart. And we can only hope that it won't be falling apart, entirely, because that would, of course, be the end of the system. So the social consensus for care for everybody is possible because everybody felt that they had a stake in that system and made a contribution, and those who couldn't yet, such as children or sick people and so on, were not seen as just taking advantage of the system. No, they're part of it, and they will be doing their part when they can. And
so is the argument to say we need to limit immigration justified? Is it a numerical scheme to say so many people and then not anymore? Is there a finite amount that we can socially agree upon, or is it...
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you look at Germany, which historically was a non-immigrant country, non-immigration country, well, as recently as 10 years ago, about 11% of the population was foreign-born, or today it is 20%, yes, 16 million people living in Germany were born elsewhere, outside of Germany, or are first-generation migrants into Germany. Well, that's a huge change. And as is the case, I suppose, with many situations of economic migrants, they're not in a position, as they come into the country, to make a contribution economically to the country. They don't have the education, they don't have the training to fit neatly into that society. It takes perhaps a generation for them to become productive and make the financial contribution as well. Now, to what extent society feels it has an obligation to welcome everybody who wants to come, whether or not they can make immediately a contribution to that society, is of course a political question over which we have now all the controversies in Europe, mm-hmm. and which might tear Europe apart or European societies apart. On the one hand, you have Hungary and Poland and Slovakia that, and to a certain extent Austria, that want to put a stop to that. And on the other hand, you have more welcoming countries, however, who also see the enormous challenge to their society. Take Sweden, mm-hmm. take Germany, where we see the political consequences of being a very open society, open to migrants, and where there's a backlash in the population that says, well, perhaps it has gone too far and we will not be able to sustain the support for all of the newcomers.
Is there... And I would see that there is a case where we can say that the government, the representing body, the stewards, if you will, of the country, have an obligation to protect their constituents before they entertain other options, such as risking the system to an imbalance, which, and I'm almost reluctant to go there, brings us very close to the idea of... Germany first, and we've had that verbiage before, and this is the verbiage that comes up recurrently as soon as, for instance, Austria with Chancellor Kurz, who wants to, or is in the process of establishing limitations as to how many people can actually immigrate to Austria and become functional members, perhaps over the course of one or two generations. We are immediately accused of being right-leaning. We are immediately accused of creating another version of Hitler. And we are immediately accused of wanting to recreate a 21st version of Arianism. Whereas I would hope that nothing would be further from the truth. However, I can also see that those who make the argument say, well, hang on a second, we've had this type of limitation, social curating before. Is there a way through this, or do you see that this is almost an impossible puzzle to resolve?
Probably difficult to resolve, if not impossible, because we have not come to terms really with the idea of... globalism as it affects national cultures. And we always have had people migrating. We always have had the difficulties with newcomers becoming integrated fully in a society. However, perhaps there are a number of questions. How much can Austria do in a given year's time in terms of accepting and integrating newcomers into society? And do we have the resources to be welcoming to all? And I think here we are talking about questions far beyond Austria or Germany or the United States. Here we are talking deep philosophical value questions. And if we are of the opinion that we can sacrifice or at least limit the benefits of our social welfare system or our economy, economic circumstances as we have learned to enjoy them individually in the United States or Europe or wherever, and have to make major sacrifices in order to welcome the newcomer, well, now we are talking about questions which of course affect the individual, affect groups which are well established in society, and they may or may not be willing to give what is necessary in order to be welcoming to the newcomer. And so I think there's definitely a question of numbers. And I suppose Chancellor Merkel got her response from the German public when she admitted or when she promoted the open door policy in 2015. And I think on a moral plane, there's no question that she did the right thing. On the political plane, we know the answer. And that as many people, even who at the time might have been at the train station in Munich when migrants arrived and handed them flowers and what have you as a welcome sign, many of them have tired too and wouldn't do that again because they say it's now enough. So I think the question of openness of all borders is one which has to be asked in a or answered in a much larger context, perhaps in the context of the European Union, and we have the answer of European Union countries. Many of them do not want an open borders. We can ask the question in terms of the possibilities available. Well, an empty continent is much more capable of admitting more and more than perhaps a continent which is already overrun with lots of people. So I think that is such a difficult question to answer. And I suppose we can hope that we have the moral grounding to make a right decision, which also has to be, however, be reflective of the practical circumstances that exist. And if you only ask the question in terms of the monies necessary to accommodate someone, I think we're on the wrong boat. If you ask the question in terms of an obligation society might have to others, and then ask itself the question, well, how can we make it possible, then we're on the right track. And I suppose we have to understand from a practical point of view that there might be limits as to what can be done.
Perhaps there should be limits. Things are only sustainable so far before the collective takes the fall. And when everybody falls, nobody wins. That's, I think, the really challenging aspect here is to say that there is a finite point of resources at the present time. And somebody is not going to make the cut. Now, that comes back to the philosophical discussion of, okay, who's the one that we decide arbitrarily, perhaps, that is going to stand outside the door looking in, not being allowed? It becomes an incredibly challenging topic for obvious reasons, but even more challenging when we look at particularly Central European history, with everything that we cannot seem to escape from or outlive, if you will. Going back to a question that I asked Fred Amram, whether we can ever be forgiven as Germans and Austrians, with what transpired through the Holocaust and whether we can actually move on. And the answer was immediately no. This is an unforgivable, never repayable debt to humanity, to 6 million Jews. And with that, we are almost incapable to say there has to be a point of finite allowance.
Yeah, and an impossible, impossible to find an easy answer to that question. I would think from a basic point of view, if we recognize that German society and Austria by extension, Austrian society by extension, simply were morally bankrupt in the Holocaust. And out of that moral bankruptcy might come not only obligations, but also insights that we can do better next time around. And this next time around may very well in part relate to the way we handle migration. But then, again, you have to look at the practical aspects, too. If 60 million Africans, black Africans, are on the march to the north, into Europe, well, can Europeans accommodate all the people who are currently on the march? And we can ask the same question for the Americas or for Asia. There are many peoples on the march because they are suffering economically and seek a better future elsewhere. Now, recognize that the people who are on the march are the most enterprising probably in the indigenous societies, because they're willing to take on the hardships of a march of a year or 2 years duration in order to get to a better future. So I have no doubt that these are people, by and large, who would make an amazing contribution also economically to the receiving society, mm-hmm. if they have a chance to do so. At the same time, that will be an immense change in those cultures, and we simply have worldwide no response, no good idea of what we do with the people in the global context, in the context of globalism, where we after all can move from country to country, from continent to continent, and in ways in which that hasn't been possible for in the past 200 years or so. So the challenges that we try to meet here, we approach with, individual country solutions. Mm-hmm. And what we should have here is really a regional or perhaps even a global approach to that. And I don't see anywhere in European countries this overarching approach. The EU has tried to do it, or at least I suppose more so under the pressure of France and Germany has tried to do it. And Europe hasn't been able to do it. The attempts have not proved to be successful. And I see nothing on the global scale where we have tried to find an answer to the question of migration. And those migrations will change societies in significant ways, mm-hmm. and we are perhaps afraid of experiencing the change, but it will come, no question. And yet we don't know what to do about it. So I don't think we are at 1930 or 1933 or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was a totally different context of the time.
Okay.
But I think the enormous burden of history on the part of Germany, on the shoulders of Germany, might perhaps, or perhaps should make Germans much more responsive to the needs of people who need protection.
I really only have two more questions left, one of which derives actually from our episode 4, where one of our students asked us, as a native Austrian, German, Swiss, what is your perspective upon meeting an American who has just gotten, for instance, their DNA results back saying, I've been identified as X percent from Germany, I identify as a German? And Claudia, Catherine, and myself tried to answer this question in a variety of ways. And I would say that none of our answers were conclusive, but they certainly were influenced by our personal perspective. And I would like to extend the same question to you. At which point can you identify as somebody from a culture that perhaps is of interest to you, or that you feel some sort of belonging to? Is there such a point, or is there none?
I don't know. I mean, why would you want to identify or claim that identity? If it's pleasing to you, do it. And so for me, it's a non-question, really. So and I grew up in Germany and without much thinking. Of course, I embraced whatever German values were and German society's learning and all of that. And that made me feel very comfortable. And I remember the time when, let's say, the German flag would go up on a flagpole. It made me feel very good. I remember the times when the German national anthem was sung, and it made me feel very good. So I identified emotionally, certainly, with the German culture. And then came a point in time when, after being in the United States for a while, when I simply had to ask the question, why? What is it that makes us want to belong and feel comfortable, as we did? And of course, after so many years of life in the United States, I identify with the United States. I identify with Germany in different ways, though. And I would think if there is a need for someone to belong or to claim a certain identity, why not? And I don't know what value it has except to make someone feel pretty good about it and perhaps interested in learning about that culture and that society. And the more understanding we have of other places and other peoples, I think the better decisions we can make for ourselves and others. And so I see the question of identity more as a personal need that someone has to belong. We all need to belong, or most of us at least need to belong, be it now in a circle of friends or be it in a circle of a larger group or society. For me personally, my sense of belonging to the German culture lessened with my experience of America.
And why is that?
We talked about the two sets of eyes. Mm-hmm. And so when I see Germany today in parts of American eyes, I see a very different Germany than, let's say, my siblings, who have lived there all the time and with whom I grew up and with whom we shared so much of our learning. And yet, I even can't make myself understood to them when I talk about Germany with a somewhat American understanding, because they simply see Germany through their eyes, and they have no way to relate except to the words that I'm saying. They understand the words, but they don't understand what's behind those words.
And can you perhaps dive into one or two examples of what those differences are in terms of worldview?
Well, it often comes out in little stupid things, really. For example, in order to be a teacher in Germany, you have to be licensed. And here in the United States, we have a much freer system whereby someone might be of help in a private school which has a licensed teacher or licensed teaching staff, but also allows people in who are not licensed and to help out. And it happened to me and my family when I once mentioned that someone here, a friend in the United States, was helping out in a school, in a Montessori school, and my siblings who are licensed teachers couldn't understand that someone could be working in a school without being a licensed teacher. The question has been raised so many times, so he said, well, my God, there's no point anymore to talk about it.
Yeah, it goes back to cultural, governmental oversight, rather.
Yeah, and that's it was a stupid little example. But take our understanding of freedom. Can you make an Austrian or German understand that there's a deep commitment in the United States to the Second Amendment, at least in a large part of the population, or perhaps a plurality of the population? It's incomprehensible, I think, for most Europeans to understand the American culture war on the Second Amendment. Take another example. Take education. So make someone understand in Europe that if you go here to a super university, a super college, it might cost you $40,000-$50,000 a year. Incomprehensible.
Oh, absolutely incomprehensible.
And make an American understand that free education should be the right of everybody. Well, it becomes part of our political wars now, our culture wars now. But the idea that you can have huge amounts of money spent, private money spent on education, is difficult to comprehend for a European. And well, we simply accept that this is a difference in the culture, and if you want to be educated here, then it's what it takes. I saw that when I tried to promote educational exchanges, that a German student, even if they came from very well situated economic circumstances, would be reluctant to put some money out for his education in the United States, because after all, it's a birthright in Europe to have free education, no matter what your circumstances. And even if you aren't very well situated economically, then the government makes it possible for you to go to university anyway, because they will pay for even your upkeep if necessary. So that's such an important difference in terms of what we can do to promote education. And yet, if you look at the outcomes, the American educational system is probably without any example in the world. That we have here colleges or university or whatever we want to call them, for almost every level of intellect, for every level of interest, which is in part, I suppose, being sought after in Europe too, now in Germany certainly, but in no way do we come close in Europe to the variety of educational opportunities that we have in the United States. Look at the elite universities, elite colleges. There's no such thing in the continental European context that can compare with the elite universities of the United States. And
Cambridge might object to that.
Well, continental Europe. Now, even if Cambridge and Oxford. I quote simply The Economist here,
sure,
when it says German universities are mediocre.
Ouch. That hurts.
That hurts. Well, or perhaps not, because then, of course, we don't take into consideration that at the same time, while much of the basic research is no longer being conducted in universities, it's done at the Max Planck Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this beautiful organization, the Fraunhofer Institute, which makes it possible for academically prepared people to, well, now apply their knowledge in a practical way. And so we have in the United States no parallel to the Fraunhofer Institute. And even though German universities might not be anymore the basic basic provider of research, well, the Max Planck Institutes do that, which are separate from the universities organizationally, but of course relate to them in many ways. So whatever the economist says, as the economist has to say about the quality of German universities, it might be right in a limited sense, and yet it doesn't describe, of course, what's happening in the academic field throughout Germany. So it always is difficult to make these comparisons. It's always difficult to fully understand what's happening, whether we are talking about freedom or mm-hmm. university education or research opportunities or healthcare. I suppose it's always difficult to understand what's happening in another country, because we have to fully be aware of the context in which these things have developed and how they flourish. And I don't know what overarching question one could ask, such as, well, where do we have best value produced, this or that system? I shy away from system comparisons or adoptions of aspects of systems mm-hmm. to another, because we seldom understand the full context of what's happening. Take our search now for better training in manufacturing industries, let's say. Mm-hmm. So we want to have copies here in the United States. We might want to copy the German apprenticeship system. Well, it doesn't work very well, I would think. Do we have the respect for manual labor in the United States that we have in Germany?
I would argue probably not.
Probably not. When I came to this country, now more than 50 years ago, one of my first cultural shocks was a statement I heard often when people would say, I improve myself. I said, what does it mean? Well, they were taking another university course or college course. That was improving oneself. Now, whatever that phrase meant besides just taking another course. But it struck me, because if I look back on German society, at least at the time I came, well, manual labor was highly respected. And manual labor, of course, has a 1,000-year tradition in Germany. And the system by which one serves a 3-year apprenticeship after some basic schooling and then becomes a journeyman and perhaps 6 years later becomes a master craftsman and then is entitled to also take on apprentices. Well, that's a long tradition and has such a deep, enjoys such a deep respect in society that if I look at my little hometown from which I came, and the master carpenter in town was a highly respected individual. The master plumber was a highly respected individual. And we don't have that same, we don't give the same respect to those traits in the United States as we do elsewhere. Well, those are, so we can talk about academic professions or labor, what have you. These are difficult to understand unless we see the entire context. One last thing about these nuances. When I went to university, I was an army officer, so I really didn't care what I would study. I wanted to be a history major. And for one day I enrolled at the University of Göttingen, and I left the room in which the enrollment took place, and a white-haired man stopped me and asked me what I wanted to do, and I said I wanted to be a historian. And he looked at me, had his doubts, and said, well, do you speak your languages? I said, which ones? And he rattled off 5 of them, and I said, no. He said, well, why don't you come back when you've learned your languages? I said, how long does it take? He said, 5 years. No, 3 years. And if you're not so smart, 5 years. I said, I don't have 8 years. What else can I do? He said, you can always be a medical doctor or lawyer. You can always be a medical doctor or lawyer. So I became a lawyer instead, or shouldn't say a lawyer, but I studied law instead. And so in terms of the perspective on academic professions in the mid-1960s, in Germany, the highest social prestige was given to the professor of philosophy, then the professor of mathematics, then the humanities. At the bottom of the rank were the practical academic professions, such as law, medicine, and dentistry, and whatever else one can do.
Well, things have significantly changed since.
Yeah, things have. Well, certainly they're always different here. Yeah, but those are the kinds of things one has to understand when we're talking about the nuances in society. If I want to earn some respect here in the United States, I say I study law because it's highly respected here. Well, who studied the law in Germany in the 1960s? Those who didn't know what to do with their life. It was simply a way to get your feet wet in the university, and there are lots of lawyers all over the place, not necessarily engaged in law. In the 1970s, in the Ministry of Economics, Federal Ministry of Economics in Germany, we employed more lawyers than economists. Law was simply a good degree, a good trade in which you learned how to think critically, which of course is universally applicable, and didn't have quite the same value, social value, as perhaps at mathematics or philosophy, where one learned different kind of thinking, I suppose.
Well, to which I would say that we probably need more philosophers nowadays than we do need attorneys. So perhaps we need to reverse this back to what it used to be. So I become sort of the proponent of, let's go back to the good old days, right? In the interest of also respecting your time, the one question that I have reserved as the last question is, when you look at the world today, what keeps you up at night?
Well, I'm often up at night, but it's not really thinking about the world. But I would think enormous challenges we have in the world would certainly be how do you put together on a global scale the economies and the politics that provide a successful life for all peoples concerned. And I don't think we have good answers to that. And our current approaches, namely on the national scale or perhaps on the regional scale, are insufficient. And we don't have, I think, developed the ability to think in those global terms and ask new questions. We're always asking have the answers that have worked perhaps in the past, perhaps take us a little bit into the future, but we are facing challenges today in the world which are without example. And so it doesn't keep me up at night because I will be long gone when all of these things will come to a crisis. But I hope what happens in the meantime is that we do develop new approaches to thinking about society and politics and make it possible for people to find reasonable answers to the question.
Thank you. We just had the pleasure to have you speak here at the Germanic American Institute. Do you have any other lectures planned anywhere in the near future where people perhaps could?
No, nothing
then
planned.
We need to get you back here again. Dr. Beckmann, thank you so much for spending time with us. It was
my pleasure.
Phenomenal. And I hope that we can repeat this in the future at some point. This was a special episode of the GAI podcast. If you do have any guests that you want to suggest to us, please feel free to send us an email to language@gai-mn.org. Again, that's language@gai-mn.org. Today, once again, we had the fabulous Dr. Beckmann as guest. An incredible conversation. I will certainly look forward to hopefully repeating the invitation and have him back again for more insights into education and economics. With that being said, thank you so much for hanging out with us, and we'll talk with you again soon.